ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। नारायणं नमस्कृत्याम् नरं चैव नरोत्तमाम् देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासाम् ततो जायामुदीरये नष्टप्रायेषु अभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवत सेवया। भगवते उत्तमा श्लोके भक्तिर्भवति न इष्टकी। So reading from the 10th canto, chapter 62, entitled The Meeting of Usha and Aniruddha, text number 11. सा तत्रतम अपश्यन्ति क्वासी कांतेति वादिनी सकीना मध्य उत्तस्तौ विवला वृदिता वृषम्। सा तत्रतम अपश्यन्ति क्वासी कांतेति वादिनी सकीना मध्य उत्तस्तौ विवला वृद्धिता वृषम्। सा तत्रतम अपश्यन्ति क्वासी कांतेति वादिनी सकीना मध्य उत्तस्तौ विवला वृद्धिता वृषम्। Mataji's. Sa, she. Tatra, there, in her dream, tam, him, apashyanti, sorry, not seeing, qua, where, asi, are you, kanta, my lover, iti, thus, vadini, speaking, sakinam, of her girlfriends, madhye, in the midst, uttastav, arose, vivala, disturbed, vridita, embarrassed, brisham, greatly. Translation and purport by the disciples of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. Translation. Losing sight of Him in our dreams, Usha suddenly sat up in the midst of her girlfriends, crying out, "Where are you, my lover?" She was greatly disturbed and embarrassed. Purport. Coming to her senses and remembering that she was surrounded by her girlfriends, Usha was naturally very embarrassed to have cried out in that way. At the same time, she was disturbed by attachment to the beloved man who had appeared in her dream. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chaksharon Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Beshtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadanti Swapadantikam Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurum Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sagana Lalitam Sri Vishakhan Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhano Sute Devi Hari Priye Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ramo Hare Ramo 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 Hare 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 Krishna. So seeking blessings of all the assembled Vaishnavas, we'll try to say a few words. So we have begun this new chapter and this new pastime. So yesterday's class, Gopinath Chandra Prabhu dealt on the first verse of this particular pastime. And today we see how Usha is in the middle of a dream, and all of a sudden she wakes up crying out for the person who was very affectionately dealing with her in her dream. And all of us have this experience of having a dream. I know many devotees also have very nice dreams about Krishna, about Srila Prabhupada, about their spiritual master. But here, right in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam, we are finding that we are having the future grand daughter-in-law of Lord Sri Krishna having a dream, which is from a spiritual perspective not considered to be very sattvic or not considered to be very good for one's spiritual life. So she's actually having a dream that she is being embraced and by a man whom she has not met as yet. So from a spiritual point of view, such a dream is not really considered to be very nice. But yet, because it's in the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's giving us an opportunity to discuss about this particular aspect of a dream and how it is that in one sense all of us are in this dreamlike state in this material world where we are going through life having so many dreams, having so many expectations from material life, And sometimes these dreams actually end up becoming a nightmare. Right? We have this expectation that it should be a dream, life should be a dream. But actually in the end we find that it is actually a nightmare. In fact, what comes to my mind is when the American civilization started in the early 16th century by the influx of Europeans to America, they founded what is called as the Great American Dream, and is there even today. Right, when you meet a diehard American and you ask him, what is it that really he identifies with in America, he will tell you that I identify myself with the Great American Dream. And what is this Great American Dream? In one sense, it's actually nothing but a dream of everyone, every human being in this material world, to have a nice and comfortable situation, a nice and comfortable family, a nice and comfortable home, right? Minimum amount of work, maximum amount of enjoyment, right? But the founding fathers of the American civilization thought it appropriate that they should write down what is the Great American Dream. And it is being quoted even today that, you know, this is something that each and every American should strive for, should aspire for. So it looks very nice, looks very beautiful, and if the human being were to live in such a situation, then actually there would be no reason for him to ever want to go home back to Godhead. Because in a situation where he is actually in that Great American Dream, everything is going on so nicely, so beautifully. Everything is so nice, maximum pleasures, just like how Usha is having. You know, in her particular dream, she's having the maximum pleasure that anybody could aspire for in this material world. Sex pleasure, right? And she is experiencing that in her dream. So, the Great American Dream also means that, you know, we have maximum sense gratification, sense pleasure. And if you see over the last 300-400 years, the Americans actually worked very hard. And of course, one of the things that they also strived for was hard work. Right, they wanted to really work hard so that they can give for their future generations a lot of comfort. Right, and if you see over the last 300-400 years, the Americans actually worked very, very hard. Right, what we see today as the America of the 21st century is because of the hard work that has been put in by the generations that have passed 200 to 300 years back. Right, some of the best roads of America are not creations of today. They belong to the early 20th century, right? The longest road in America is the I-6, which goes practically from California right up to Massachusetts, right? Which is a distance of about 3,500 miles, right? So that's one single road cutting across the whole length and breadth of America, right? And those are not roads that we see here in Bombay. Right, these are 8-laners, right? That means 4 lanes on each side. And incredible, the amount of planning that the Americans have done, if you really go to analyze their creative ability and their determination to really facilitate material nature to its maximum so that their sense gratification can also be facilitated to the maximum, the amount of creativity that the American fathers have applied is really incredible. Everything has been planned so systematically, not like what we have here in India. Everything grows, you know, spontaneously. You know, suddenly a road comes up somewhere, suddenly a, you know, building comes up somewhere, and, you know, right in the middle of nowhere you have, you know, a building coming up, and, you know, it's such a mess, right? Like, I remember, if you how many of us have visited the house of Adhikeshwar Prabhu? Right, 20 years back when we were, you know, just coming into the temple and used to go to Adhikeshwar Prabhu's house very regularly, you know, there was no buildings around Adhikeshwar Prabhu's house. There was just one building and practically there were no building. But today, Adhikeshwar Prabhu's house is there in the middle and you have a building all 4 sides. Absolutely no ventilation. Right? So this is how the growth has taken place in our Amchi Mumbai, right? But if you go to America, you know, you will find that this is the amount of planning that has gone into everything that they do. It's extremely systematic and extremely methodical. The roads, the highways are nowhere near to the places where people live. It's miles away, right? So you have this I-6, as I said, which cuts across the length and breadth of America. But, you know, for a person who is living in the suburbs of America, he would not see the I-6 unless and until he wants to drive onto it. It is one of the main arteries which connects America, but it's actually not visible. And that is the glory of a country like America, which has really seen that much of intelligence being applied to ensure that everything is so systematic. And they have this housing developments also which take place, extremely systematic. First and foremost, you have to have all the infrastructure necessary before you actually start building your own houses. That means the water, the sewage, the electricity, right? The shopping malls, the schools, the hospitals, everything has to be within an immediate vicinity of maybe 1 or 2 miles. And then you are given the building permit in order to construct your house. Right? So what it ultimately means is that a person, when he constructs his house, he has all the basic facilities that are required in order to fulfill that great American dream. Right? So that is the planning, and that is what, you know, the earlier generations have done in order to ensure that America is what it is today. But does it mean that the people in America are happy? Unfortunately, no. Because however much we may try to facilitate material nature for our sense gratification, still we will find that instead of actually giving us happiness, it gives us so much of more unhappiness. Because now the present generation, actually they don't work very hard. Because they have all the facilities already created for themselves, and you will find that a typical American is not inclined to work very hard in order to increase the standard of his living. Because the way the government has arranged everything is that even if a person does not work, then he is assured of a minimum subsistence. He gets a grant from the government, he gets a house, and he gets a certain amount of allowance. So what does he need? Why should he work? Where is the impetus for him to work? Right? So that same civilization which tried to create all the facilities for the future generations are ending up today with the future generation actually going into drugs, alcohol, murder, crime, right? The same generation which the forefathers wanted that they should be having a comfortable standard of living is today being caught up in a situation where there is so much of unhappiness. Like the prison situation in America. Just as an example, you will see that 25, and it's really a very amazing statistic. When I came across this, I was really, really surprised. Of course, in one sense, not surprised, because that's what the present American civilization is today. 25% of the prisoners worldwide are in America. Now, this is... That means 75% of the prisoners are in the rest 200 countries of the world. Right? Now, that's a big number. So, this 25% actually amounts to 7 million Americans are in America's prisons today. And I was watching a nice documentary on this particular, aspect of the prison system in America. Because, you know, a lot of our devotees go and preach over there. Chandamouli Swami has in fact written a book on preaching in the prisons. Actually, in one sense, the prison, they tried to create the prison environment as nice as the environment outside. Actually, the prison, you know, some of the prisons are spread over thousands of acres. Some of the biggest prisons in America are spread over thousands of acres, and the people in the prisons, so far as they follow the rules and regulations of that prison, they're actually given a very good standard of living. I mean, they don't have to do any work. Everything is paid for by the state. The taxpayer, the guy who's actually working very hard, is ending up paying for those people who are actually put into the jail for various crimes. But The sad part is, because of their independent nature, even in such a situation, they are not happy. And they create so much of commotion inside the prison for the guards that they have various levels of prisons within a prison. Right? The first level of prison is where a person is put, where he can intermingle with people and, you know, he is given a particular amount of particular service to do. He does his service and then, you know, he has a little bit of social connection with his fellow inmates and, you know, he does whatever he wants and so on. So that's like the heavenly planet within the prison system. Everything is very nice and comfortable. You get your 3 meals a day, you get nice fresh clothes, you get a nice room to stay in, you get a television. So that's the heavenly planet within the prison system. But then if you don't cooperate with the authorities, and invariably this is what is most amazing, majority of the people who are brought into the prison are not happy in that particular situation. Right? Then there's a next level of prison, which is confinement, where they are confined into a room. And inside that room, you know, they don't have any facilities, but they have, it's about 40 to 50 square feet of room, but they have their own room for themselves. So that is minimum confinement. So that's the next level. And you won't believe it, there is one more level. In fact, there are two levels after that. The third level is solitary, not solitary confinement, but somewhere between minimum confinement and solitary confinement, where for 23 hours of the day, they are kept in the room and there is no contact with the outside world. 1 hour a day, they are allowed to go outside and exercise. Right? And even during that 1 hour, they are put into a cage. That means you go directly from your room into a cage because you are viewed as a threat to society. And of course, the last one is the death row, where a person who is confined, who is supposed to be executed, he goes into that particular section of the prison, which is completely isolated. There is absolutely no sound. The room is completely soundproof, right? There's absolutely, of course, there's no television or anything in the room. The toilet, you know, the toilet doesn't have any seats. There is no article in that particular room which has the potential to be converted into a weapon, because that person, you know, is suicidal at that particular point of time. He wants to commit suicide. So, you know, if there is anything in the room which is available to him to be converted into a weapon, then he will do it. Sometimes to kill himself, sometimes to kill even the guards, because, you know, that person is so, he's in such a state of mind, pathetic state of mind, that, you know, he's capable of doing anything. So 7 million prisoners in America. That means every out of 100 people in America, 2 are prisoners, because the population of America is just 300 million. Right? Now that's a big statistic. What does it reveal? So it reveals that the great American dream is not very correct the way they have pictured it, or at least not very correct the way they have attempted to make it. Right? And who are these people who are actually, you know, like this documentary, it interviews so many different people who have been taken into the jail. And most of the people have had such traumatic childhoods. They have been abused. They have been abused as children. They have been sexually abused as children. Right? Most of them had only one parent. Several of them had no parents at all. They just came onto the streets by the time they were 10 or 11 years of age. And these criminals just keep going again and again and again back into the prison. The state tries its level best to reform them, right? Like I said, there's 4 levels of prison. So people, you know, are given reprieve at different points of time. After a few years, if a person is really behaving very well, then he's released from the prison. But then invariably that fellow comes back after a few years, or even after a few months. So this the childhood that a person goes through has such an impact on his thought process, that is consciousness, that you know it carries on to him throughout his life. And what is really amazing is that you know the government somehow has not figured out a way by which it can ensure for the families who are part of this great American dream a nice situation whereby the product of this family would not end up going to prison. The government has not yet figured that out. I mean, they are trying their level best, they are racking their brains, and they are coming out with various options and so on. But still, at the grassroots level, the children are, you know, not the way they should be. And the whole fault primarily lies with the parents, because the way they bring up their child, invariably both the parents are working. Because in order to sustain yourself in that great American dream, it is necessary that both the parents should work. So invariably the mother and the father both are working, because they have a mortgage on the house, they have a mortgage on the car, sometimes they have a mortgage on the children's education in case the child has already grown up and going to college. So a whole series of mortgages ensure that both the husband and wife are perpetually working. And if you go into the shopping malls, if you go into the restaurants, you will find that the people who are actually serving over there are sometimes 65 and 70 year old people. Now, isn't this tragic that economy which is actually supposed to be trying to take care of its people to ensure that they have a nice and comfortable standard of living, towards the end of their life, instead of providing for them a nice standard of living, those people are actually ending up, you know, working in supermarkets and restaurants and hotels and so on, right? Because they just have to maintain themselves. There's no other option. And this is also a very, very revealing statistic. 80% of Americans' population, the working population, just have adequate money to take care of 6 months of their life in the event they lose their job. So that's the amount of savings that a typical 80% of a typical American family has set aside for contingencies. Because the facilities over there to enjoy and to gratify your senses is so vast that people invariably end up spending more than that they earn. And invariably they are always in debt. So contrast this to the situation that we have in India. We have Parikshit Maharaj. We have Ambarish Maharaj. Right? Now these personalities are not part of any dream. They are emperors of the entire planet. They have all the opulences. They have all the facilities that they could, that any person could ever want. But if you take the example of Parikshit Maharaj, you will see that in his life, how it was that a small mistake that he made, which of course he repented from the core of his heart, and he was just thinking, you know, that for sure I'm going to be getting the retribution that is necessary, that is going to come as a result of this offense that I had committed. Just when he was thinking like that, a messenger from Shamik Rishi comes to him and tells him that you just have 7 days to live. Beautiful purport of Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada says that real happiness is achieved by spiritual existence or by cessation of the repetition of birth and death. One can stop the repetition of birth and death only by going home back to Godhead. In the material world, attaining even the topmost planet, Brahma Loka, one cannot get rid of the conditions of repeated birth and death. But still, we do not accept the path of perfection. And then Srila Prabhupada says that actually Shamik Rishi was a mystic and Parikshit Maharaj was a devotee. Both of them were unafraid of death. Both of them were ready to face death at any time. And Parikshit Maharaj, although he knew that if he approached Shamik Rishi, and begged for forgiveness. Shamikrishi would have forgiven him. But because Parikshit Maharaj already knew that Shamikrishi was feeling so repentant that his son had behaved in such a fashion, Parikshit Maharaj did not have any courage to go and ask him for forgiveness. In any case, he thought that this is the arrangement of the Lord. Let me just now accept it and perfect my life and go home back to Godhead. Right, recently we were in Varanasi. And Varanasi is just like any other holy place that we have in India. Right? Some holy places are more potent, some holy places are, you know, less so. But what is really significant about Varanasi is, it's a gateway to Vaikuntha, of course we all know that. But the sense of detachment that one finds in Varanasi is really amazing. Most people who live in Varanasi actually come over there to die. And they are accepting life as it comes. No expectations, no dreams, just living life, let's say from our terminology, existing, right? Just waiting for that particular time when they would leave their body. Because leaving your body in Varanasi means you go home back to Vaikuntha, right? We were talking with the pujari who was actually doing some functions for us. And he was with such conviction. He was saying that if you die here in Varanasi, for sure you will go home back to Vaikuntha. Absolutely no doubt in his mind. And then we visited all the ghats, and the maximum number of people who were there in any of the ghats were in Manikarnika ghat. Right? And we were also fascinated by the place, having heard, you know, how His Holiness Radhana Swami had visited Manikarnika ghat and he had actually meditated over there and, you know, spend so much of time looking at this dead bodies burning. In fact, there's a very beautiful class where Maharaj describes graphically. And actually, heart of hearts, I wanted to go and see for myself whether that actually happened over there. Like Maharaj was describing how when a person's body is burned, the first things to go off is the hair, right? And then the sound, Maharaj makes a sound when the hair just burns off. And then different parts of the body are burning and then all of a sudden these eyeballs pop out. I mean, that must be an incredible sight to see, the eyeballs popping out, like because of the pressure that is built up from within the body, the eyeballs just come out. And there were at least, when we visited Manikarnika ghat, there were at least half a dozen funeral pyres burning. And a huge number of people were just watching the bodies burning, just so that they can meditate upon this temporary body that we are part of, right? So it's the great culture of India, which gives us an opportunity for us to visit all these places and meditate upon the ultimate destination for all of us, all the human beings, all the living entities in this world. At some point of time or the other, we have to face death. And the question is, are we ready to face death? Right? In a place like America, the Americans are not ready to face death. In fact, and this is really surprising, about 20 years back when we were in Germany, we were going in a train and we were talking to some Germans who were there in the train. And, you know, since they could understand that we are from India, and we got started talking about Krishna consciousness, and I started telling them about, you know, how it is that this life is temporary and so on. And then, you know, for the first time, that couple said, "Do you know one thing? You know, we have been living in Germany for 5 years and till date we have never ever seen a dead body." Because the system in all these Western countries is, the moment you die, they just whisk you away from there. Right? And then you're taken to a funeral parlor and you're very beautifully decorated. Sometimes you look more beautiful than you looked when you were alive. They give you a very wonderful situation, you know, very wonderful casket, and you are there with a lot of flowers around you and a beautiful smile on your face, and, you know, with a lot of mascara on your body, on your face, and so on. And from there you go directly to the burial ground. Yeah, and you're just put under the earth, and you're gone. Nobody even looks at you anymore, right? But here in Varanasi, right for everyone to see in Manikarnika Ghat, thousands of people are coming there and watching how people's bodies are getting burned. Because that's a way by which we realize how temporary this body is. And how it is that sooner or later we are going to meet that destination. So what actually for Maharaj Parikshit should have become a nightmare, because he was actually at this particular point of time told that you're going to die in 7 days, which from anybody's perspective is actually a nightmare come true, that 7 days or maybe 1 month or 2 months or 6 months later I'm going to die. And then Sukadev Goswami comes over there and starts telling Maharaj Parikshit how it is that Maharaj Katvanga, when he was given this opportunity to ask for a benediction by Indra, Maharaj Katvanga just asked, how much time do I have to leave? And when he was told that he has only one moment, then immediately he prepares himself to go home back to Godhead. And this particular story, I was just thinking that I'll ask this pujari in Varanasi, and he gave me a slightly different perspective. He said that when Maharaj Katvanga asked for this benediction, when Indra told Maharaj Katvanga to ask a benediction, and Indra told him also that you can ask for horses, you can ask for chariots, you can ask for gold, you can ask for whatever you want, everything I'll give you. And Maharaj Katvanga said, are you sure that you'll give me whatever I want? I mean, this is the pujari narrating this particular pastime. So, yes, I'll give you whatever you want. So then Maharaj Katvanga says, okay, you tell me how much more time do I have to live? And then this Lord Indra says, oh, I'm not able to give that particular answer, but let me just go to Vaikuntha. I will ask Narayan and then I'll come back. So he goes to Vaikuntha and comes back in a second. And then he says, you've got 1 hour to live. So Maharaj Katvanga said, oh, I've got 1 hour to leave only. Then let me just, finish off all my material duties and let me sit down in a place and, And then Maharaj Katvanga sits in this place. And then he wants to focus on Krishna, on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But then after 45 minutes of closing his eyes and meditating, he starts crying profusely. So then Indra asks him, what happened? Why are you crying? So Maharaj Katvanga says that for the last 45 minutes I've been trying to focus my consciousness on Krishna. But actually, you know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking about my family, I'm thinking about my sons, I'm thinking about my bank balance, I'm thinking about, all my army that I have, I'm thinking of all my wives and how much enjoyment I had with them and how much, everything was so nice in my life. All these thoughts were coming into my mind. And now, I've got only 15 minutes to leave. When am I going to remember Krishna? And he started profusely crying. And then Indra told him, okay, don't worry. Now that you have finished off with all the thoughts of your family members, I think now you will be able to focus on Krishna. And then Katvanga Maharaj, for 15 minutes, he meditated on Lord Krishna and then, departed for the spiritual world. So, of course, it's a slightly different version than what Srimad Bhagavatam tells us. But for all of us, how true it is that when we actually would be facing with imminent death, sometimes 1 hour, sometimes 1 week, sometimes 1 month, how much of that time we are actually going to be spending remembering Krishna? Or how much of that time are we going to be meditating upon all the good things that happened to us, all the wonderful occasions that we had, all the dreams that we had, all the things that we wanted to achieve in life, all the relations that we had with our family members, with our friends, with our loved ones? How much of our time are we going to actually focus on that? And how much of our time are we going to focus on Krishna? Right? So this is actually the concern that should be there in our minds for the remaining part of our time. And this concern will come about only when we become fearless. Because our nature is that we are afraid of death. We are afraid of any pain that comes to our body. Because we are pleasure seeking and we want to push out pain. But the scriptures give us such wonderful examples of personalities who in times of great tribulation were able to withstand and come out successful. Like we have this example of Maharaj Ambarish. Right? Now if you were to be in his situation, what would we do? Now here is a personality who is doing his fast. The time has come for him to break his fast, and he's about to break his fast when Durvasmuni comes. And Durvasmuni has such expectations from him that he should be taken care of very nicely and so on. And then he comes and then he starts cursing, and then he creates this huge demon. And then this demon is coming straight at Maharaj Ambarish. Now this is death coming right in front of you. Right? Maharaj Ambarish is unarmed. He doesn't have any weapons with him. He doesn't have his armies with him. And even if he had, this huge personality would have just devoured all of them in a moment. But then here this huge personality is coming right in the face of imminent death. Maharaj Ambarish just stood over there meditating on Krishna. Right? And just practically at that last moment when the demon would have, or supposedly would have killed Ambarish, at that particular point of time, the Sudarshan Chakra came and chopped off the head of this demon. Right? I was listening to this very beautiful class of Mahavishnu Goswami Maharaj, where Maharaj was saying that, what is the difference between Durvasmuni and Maharaj Ambarish? Durvasmuni, as soon as he got the Sudarshan Chakra on his back, he started trying his level best to avoid or to escape death. The Sudarshan Chakra means death. So Sudarshan Chakra is chasing Durvasmuni and is going to different personalities. First he goes to Brahmaji, then he goes to Shiva, then he goes to Vaikuntha and he meets Narayan. And what does Narayan tell him? Very beautiful shloka in the ninth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Aham bhakta paradino yashvat tantra iva dvija sadubir grasta hridayo bhakter bhakta janapriya. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said to the Brahmana Durvasmuni, I am completely under the control of my devotees. I am not at all independent. Because my devotees are completely devoid of material desires, I sit only within the cords of their heart. What to speak of my devotee, even those who are the devotees of my devotees are very dear to me. So, in the Association of Devotees in Sri Radha Gopinath Temple and this International Society for Krishna Consciousness given to us by Srila Prabhupada and all the Acharyas, our only goal should be to try and become dear to the devotees of the devotees. Because our aspiration to become dear to Krishna is very lofty. It's very far, because Krishna is unattainable for ordinary mortals like us. Unless and until we come to the stage of bhava and prem, you know, for us who are struggling with our senses, our anarthas, for us to be aspiring to become servants of Krishna is an impossible task. But Lord Narayan is saying over here that if you become dear to my devotee, then I am sold out to that person. So that's the benefit of this wonderful society of that Srila Prabhupada has given us, that let us try to become dear to the devotees of the Lord. By becoming dear to them, Krishna is pleased. And that process is so easy. Just by having wonderful relationship with Vaishnavas, by trying to serve them, by trying to associate with them, by listening to them, by hearing Bhagavatam classes that are there here in Radha Gopinath temple, or in any of the temples of ISKCON all over the world. We have this opportunity to be connecting with devotees every day. So it's a glorious opportunity for us to perfect our lives without having to go through any of the sufferings that either Maharaj Parikshit or Ambarish went through, without that trauma, just by being in the association of devotees. So we are all very fortunate, and we have to take advantage of this association, because that is the only hope for us in this age of Kali Yuga, that we become dear to devotees, and by that Krishna is pleased. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Any questions? You can. Yes. Kapasendra Prabhu.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. You said about that there is a big mess in India. So, in spite of the fact that our forefathers, the previous generations, they were, is it that they were totally focused in developing, giving spiritual knowledge and things like that, that did not focus on foundation for a good civilization, I mean materially flourishing civilization?
It's not that they didn't focus on material civilization, because their focus was on Krishna consciousness and focus on, you know, elevating their own consciousness. So what is it that we make the priority of our life? You know, according to that, that particular civilization will mature. In America and in the Western countries, they made it the focus of their life to provide facilities for sense gratification. So they are experts in that. So it's either this or that. It's very rarely that you'll have a situation like Maharaj Parikshit or Maharaj Ambarish that, you know, had both material opulence plus spiritual opulence, right? So the West have taken that option, but the East has taken this option. So that's where, you know, we have to consider ourselves fortunate that we are in the East and not in the West. People from the West want to come to the East. Like, I was seeing for myself how it is in Varanasi. There are so many spiritual seekers, Western spiritual seekers. So you can see that they are also disgusted with this material civilization that they are experiencing there in the West, which has got all facilities for sense gratification, but they are not happy over there. They are able to see for themselves. So they are coming, even in Varanasi, which from a material perspective is extremely, extremely austere. Right, the roads are very small, there's always sewage overflowing from the gutters, there are pigs everywhere. And so from a material point of view, Varanasi is really not the place that anybody would, any Westerner would want to come. But because they have realized that this is the place where we can get happiness. And that's what Prabhupada says here in the purport of this particular words regarding Parikshit Maharaj, that real happiness is only when we take to the path of spirituality. So that conviction for us gets reinforced when we visit places like this. And actually we see that, you know, even though there might be so much of material issues in such places where there's not any facilities, yet because the places by itself are so powerfully, spiritually potent, we can experience that vibration. If you go to Varanasi, if you go to Vrindavan, you see the spiritual potency of that place. You experience it for yourself. So that's our great fortune. So the registration for Yatra closed yesterday. Now over 5,000 people have registered for the Yatra. That it's such a great opulence that we have. So many devotees can go to Vrindavan Dham. Although from a material point of view, Bombay is much better than Vrindavan. But still, Vrindavan is where the heart is. Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Prabhu.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai.